don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. We are jumping right back in to section 5 of the iterative capital thesis on the cryptocurrency phenomenon. Obviously, the same disclaimer here I'll put at the front is if you have not listened to sections 1 through 4 and the first half of part 5, this is going to seem a little random. You'll be jumping right in the middle of it. I think this will be part 7. This will be the 7th episode where we have covered this piece. And there should be 2 left, I think. Yeah, 2 episodes left, because I think we'll hit 6 and 7 as a single episode each. And that will finish out the week with Thursday and Friday, and we will finish this amazing piece on the cryptocurrency phenomenon. One last thing to note before we jump into this is, again, if you would like to support the show, I know Christmas season is here, so if you would go to cryptoeconomy.life and use my affiliate link for any shopping that you do on Amazon, it will pay me a small percentage, and it won't cost you anything. You just go to Amazon through that link, and Amazon is obviously looks exactly the same as Amazon always does, same prices and everything, but you support the show by using my affiliate link. So thank you for everyone who does that for me. All right, without further ado, let's jump in to section 5, machine consensus via proof of work, starting halfway through at the rise of specialized hardware. Over the years, cryptocurrency mining has graduated from CPU to GPU to specialized hardware such as FPGA, field programmable gate arrays, and ASICs. Because of the competitive nature of mining, miners are incentivized to operate more efficient hardware even if it means higher upfront cost paid for those machines. As some hardware manufacturers upgrade to faster and more efficient machines, others are forced to upgrade too, and an arms race emerges. Today, for the notable networks, mining is largely dominated by ASICs. Bitcoin's SHA-256D is a relatively simple computation. The job of a Bitcoin ASIC is to apply the SHA-256D hash function trillions of times per second, something that no other type of semiconductor can do. First introduced in the 1980s, ASICs transformed the chip industry. In the cryptocurrency world, ASIC manufacturers, for example Bitmain, design chip architecture based on the specific hash algorithm for a given network. After going through multiple iterations and tests, the design graphic for the photomask of the circuit is then sent to foundries such as TSMC and Samsung as part of the process known as a tape-out. The actual performance of the chips is not known until the chips return from the foundry. At this point, the ASIC manufacturer needs to optimize for thermal design and chip alignment on the hashing board before the product is ready for production use. The rise of application-specific hardware is inevitable and a natural trend in the computing hardware evolution. Much like how technology in gold mining and oil drilling developed over time as the base commodities became more and more valuable, application-specific hardware is improving quickly as the result of cryptocurrency becoming more attractive. While short-term price action is mainly driven by speculation and has been observed to decorrelate with hash rate, over the long run, the two factors form a virtuous feedback loop. Figure 14. Market size of the blockchain hardware market by revenues and growth rate globally, 2012 to 2020. Figure 15. Market size of blockchain hardware market by revenues and growth rate in China, 2013 to 2020. past, present, and future of ASIC manufacturing. A cryptocurrency miner is a heterogeneous computing system, which refers to systems using multiple types of processors. Heterogeneous computing is becoming more common as Moore's Law slows down. Gordon Moore, originator of the eponymous law, predicted that transistor density in semiconductor manufacturing would produce continuous and predictable hardware improvements, but that these improvements had only 10 to 20 years before they reached fundamental physical limits. The first generation of Bitcoin ASICs included China's ASIC Miner, Sweden's KNC, and Butterfly Labs and Cointerra in the US. Application-specific hardware quickly showed its promise. The first batch of ASIC Miner hit the market in February 2013. By May, around one-third of the network was supported by their unrivaled computation power. Integrated circuit competition is all about how quickly a company can iterate the product and achieve economies of scale. Without sufficient prior experience about hardware manufacturing, ASIC Miner rapidly lost market share due to delay and a series of critical strategic mistakes. Around the same time in 2013, Jihan Wu and Ketuan Zhan started Bitmain. In the early days of Bitcoin ASICs, simply improving upon the previous generation's chip density or tech node offered an instant and efficient upgrade. Getting advanced tech nodes from foundries is always expensive, so the challenge was less about superior technical design, but more about the ability to fundraise. Shortly after the launch of Bitmain, the company rolled out the Antminer S1 using TSMC's 55-nanometer chip. In 2014, the cryptocurrency market entered into a protracted bear market, with the price of Bitcoin dropping nearly 90%. By the time the market recovered in 2015, the Antminer S5, Bitmain's then-latest machine, was the only product available to meet the demand. Bitmain quickly established its dominance. Subsequently, the lead engineer from ASIC Miner joined Bitmain as a contractor and developed the S7 and S9. These two machines went on to become the most successful cryptocurrency ASIC products sold to date. The semiconductor industry is fast-paced. Increased competition, innovations in production, and economies of scale mean the price of chips keep falling. For large ASIC mining companies to sustain their profit margins, they must tirelessly seek incremental design improvements. How the hardware game is changing. In the past, producing a faster generation of chips simply required placing transistors closer together on the chip substrate. The distance between transistors is measured in nanometers. As chip designers begin working with cutting-edge tech nodes with transistor distances as low as 7 nanometers, the improvement in performance may not be proportional to the decrease in distance between transistors. Bitmain has reportedly tried to tape out new Bitcoin ASIC chips at 16 nanometers, 12 nanometers, and 10 nanometers, as of March 2018. The tape-out of all of these chips allegedly resulted in failure, which cost the company almost $500 million. After the bull run in 2017, many new original equipment manufacturers, OEMs, are entering the Bitcoin ASIC arena. While Bitmain is still the absolute leader in terms of size and product sales, the company is clearly lagging behind on performance of its core products. InnoSilicon, Canaan, Bitfury, WhatsMiner, started by the same engineer who designed S7 and S9, and others are quickly catching up, compressing margins for all players. As the pace of tech node improvement slows down, ASIC performance becomes increasingly dependent on the company's architectural design skills. Having an experienced team to implement fully custom chip design is therefore critical for ASIC manufacturers to succeed in the future. In the long term, ASIC design will become more open source and accessible, leading to commoditization. Figure 16. mining hardware, and mining difficulty. Bitcoin mining started out as a hobbyist's activity which could be done on a laptop. From the chart above, we can see the accelerating move to industrialized mining. Instead of running mining rigs in a garage or basement, industrialized mining groups, cloud mining providers, and hardware manufacturers themselves today build or renovate data centers specifically tailored for cryptocurrency mining. Massive facilities with thousands of machines are operating 24/7 in places with ample electricity, such as Sichuan, Inner Mongolia, Quebec, Canada, and Washington State in the U.S. In the cutthroat game of mining, a constant cycle of infrastructure upgrades requires operators to make deployment decisions quickly. Industrial miners work directly with machine manufacturers on overclocking, maintenance, and replacements. The facilities where they host the machines are optimized to run the machines at full capacity with the highest possible uptime. Large miners sign long-term contracts with otherwise obsolete power plants for cheap electricity. It is a win-win situation. Miners gain access to large capacity at a close to zero electricity rate, and power plants get consistent demand on the grid. Over time, cryptocurrency networks will behave like evolving organisms, seeking out cheap and underutilized power, and increasing the utility of far-flung facilities that exist outside present-day industrial centers. Proof-of-work cryptocurrencies depend on appending blocks to the chain to maintain consensus. Over the years, many have voiced concern about the high amount of energy consumed in producing Bitcoin. Satoshi Nakamoto himself addressed this concern in 2010, saying, quote, "It's the same situation as gold and gold mining. The marginal cost of gold mining tends to stay near the price of gold. Gold mining is a waste, but that waste is far less than the utility of having gold available as a medium of exchange. I think the case will be the same for Bitcoin. The utility of the exchanges made possible by Bitcoin will far exceed the cost of electricity used. Therefore, not having Bitcoin would be the net waste." End quote. The delicate balance of terror when miners rule. In a permissionless cryptocurrency system like Bitcoin, large miners are also potential attackers. Their cooperation with the network is predicated on profitability. Should an attack become profitable, it's likely that a large-scale miner will attempt it. Those who follow the recent history of Bitcoin are aware that the topic of miner monopolies is controversial. Some participants believe ASICs are deleterious to the health of the network in various ways. In the case of hash rate concentration, the community is afraid of miners' collective ability to wage what is known as a 51% attack, wherein a miner with the majority of hash rate can use this computing power to rewrite transactions or double spend funds. Such attacks are common in smaller networks, where the cost of achieving 51% of the hash rate is low. Any mining pool or cartel of mining pools with over 51% of the hash rate owns the, quote, nuclear weapon in the network, effectively holding the community hostage with raw hash rate. This scenario is reminiscent of Cold War-era nuclear strategist Albert Wallstetter's notion of a delicate balance of terror. Quote, "The balance is not automatic. First, since thermonuclear weapons give an enormous advantage to the aggressor, it takes great ingenuity and realism at any given level of nuclear technology to devise a stable equilibrium. And second, this technology itself is changing with fantastic speed. Deterrence will require an urgent and continuing effort." End quote. While large miners can theoretically initiate attacks that bends the consensus history to their likings, they also risk tipping off the market to their attack, causing a sudden collapse of the token price. Such a price collapse would render the miner's hardware investment worthless, along with any previously earned coins held long. In the case where manufacturing is highly concentrated, clandestine 51% attacks are easier to achieve. Figure 17, Minor Concentration by Pool. In the past few years, Bitmain has dominated the market both in the form of hash rate concentration and manufacturing concentration. At the time of the writing, analysts at Sanford C. Bernstein & Co. estimate that Bitmain controls 85% of the market for cryptocurrency mining chips. Tyranny of structurelessness when core developers rule. While hostile miners pose a constant threat to permissionless cryptocurrency systems, the dominance of the core software developers can be just as detrimental to the integrity of the system. In a network controlled by a few elite technologists, spurious changes to the code may not be easily detectable by miners and full node operators running the code. Communities have taken various approaches to counter miners' overwhelming amount of influence. The team at SiaCoin decided to manufacture its own ASIC miner upon learning of Bitmain's Sia miner. Communities such as Zcash take a cautiously welcoming attitude to ASICs. New projects such as Grin designed the hashing algorithm to be RAM, or random access memory, intensive, so that ASICs are more expensive to manufacture. Some projects, such as Monero, have taken a much harsher stance, changing the hashing algorithm just to render one manufacturer's ASIC machines inoperable. The fundamental divide here is less about decentralization and more about which faction controls the means of producing Coinbase rewards valued by the marketplace. It is a fight over control of the golden goose. Due to the highly dynamic nature of decentralized networks, to swiftly act against power concentration around miners could lead to the opposite extreme, power concentration around developer figureheads. Both types of concentration are equally dangerous. The latter extreme leads to a tyranny of structurelessness, wherein the community worships the primary committers in a cult of personality and under a false premise that there is no formal power hierarchy. This term comes from social theorist Joe Freeman, who wrote in 1972, quote, "As long as the structure of the group is informal, the rules of how decisions are made are known only to a few, and awareness of power is limited to those who know the rules. Those who do not know the rules and are not chosen for initiation must remain in confusion or suffer from paranoid delusions that something is happening of which they are not quite aware." End quote. A lack of formal structure becomes an invisible barrier for newcomer contributors. In a cryptocurrency context, this means that the open allocation governance system discussed in the last section may go awry, despite the incentive to add more development talent to the team, thus increasing project velocity and the value of the network. Dominance of either miners or developers may result in changes to the development roadmap which may undermine the system. An example is the erroneous narrative perpetuated by, quote, large block miners. The Bitcoin network eventually split into two on August 1st, 2017, as some miners pushed for larger blocks, which would have increased the cost for full node operators, who play a crucial role in enforcing rules on a proof-of-work blockchain. Higher costs might mean fewer full node operators on the network, which in turn brings miners one step closer to upsetting the balance of power in their own favor. Another example of imbalance would be Ethereum Foundation. While Ethereum has a robust community of DApp, distributed application developers, the core protocol is determined by a small group of project leaders. In preparation for Ethereum's Constantinople hard fork, the developers made the decision to reduce mining rewards by 33% without consulting the miners. Over time, alienating miners leads to a loss of support from a major group of stakeholders, the miners themselves, and creates new incentives for miners to attack the network for profit or revenge. Market consensus is achieved when humans and machines agree. So far, we have discussed human consensus and machine consensus in the Bitcoin protocol. Achievement of these two forms of consensus leads to a third type, which we will call market consensus. Figure 18, Consensus in the marketplace results from human and machine consensus. The three legs are deeply intertwined, and they require each other for the whole system to work well. Many cryptocurrency projects, including Bitcoin, have suffered from either a delicate balance of terror and/or tyranny of structurelessness at various times in their history. This is one source of the rapidly changing perceptions of Bitcoin and the subsequent price volatility. Can these oscillations between terror and tyranny be attenuated? Attenuating the oscillation between terror and tyranny. Some projects have chosen to reduce the likelihood of a, quote, delicate balance of terror by resisting the participation of ASIC miners. A common approach is to modify the proof-of-work algorithm to require more RAM to compute the block hash. This effectively makes ASIC miners more expensive and therefore riskier to manufacture. However, this is a temporary measure, assuming the network grows and survives. As the underlying cryptocurrency becomes more valuable, manufacturers are incentivized to roll out these products, as evidenced in Zcash, Ethereum, and potentially the Grin Mimblewimble project. Some think that mining centralization in proof-of-work systems is an ineluctable problem. Over the years, there have been various proposals for different consensus protocols that do not involve mining or energy expenditure. The most notable of these approaches is known as proof-of-stake. Proof-of-stake consensus is a poor alternative. While there are various ways to implement proof-of-stake, an alternative consensus mechanism for proof-of-work, the core idea is that in order to produce a block, a miner has to prove that they own a certain amount of the network coins. In theory, holding the network asset reduces one's incentive to undermine the network, because the value of one's own positions will drop. In practice, the proof-of-stake approach proves to be problematic in systems where the coins at stake were not created through proof-of-work. Prima facie, if coins are created out of thin air at no production cost, the value of one's stake may not be a deterrent to a profitable attack. This is called the nothing-at-stake critique. So far in this section, we have not discussed other ways of producing coins besides proof-of-work mining. However, in some alternative cryptocurrency systems, it is possible to create pre-mined coins at no cost with no proof of work before the main blockchain is launched. Projects such as Ethereum called for the pre-mining of a vast majority of the circulating supply of coins, which were sold to insiders at a fraction of miners' cost of production. Combining a pre-mine with proof of work mining for later coins is not necessarily a dishonest practice, but if undisclosed, gives the erroneous impression that all coins in existence have a cost of production value. In this light, Ethereum's stated transition to proof-of-stake should be viewed with some skepticism. Fully dressing down proof-of-stake consensus is beyond the scope of this essay, except to say that it is not a viable replacement for proof-of-work consensus mechanisms. Some proof-of-stake implementations try to circumvent attack vectors with clever incentive schemes, such as in Ethereum's yet-to-be-released slasher mechanism. The critical fault of proof-of-stake systems is the source of pseudo-randomness used to select block producers. While in proof-of-work, randomizing the winner of block rewards is accomplished through the expenditure of large amounts of computing power and finding the correct block hash with the right number of prepended zeros, things work differently in proof-of-stake. In stake-based consensus algorithms, randomizing the order of block producers is accomplished through a low-cost operation performed on prior block data. This self-referential process is easily compromised should anyone figure out how to predict the next block producer. Attempting such predictions has little or no cost. In short, consensus on history built with proof-of-stake is not immutable, and is therefore not useful as the basis for a digital economy. However, corporate or state-run projects may successfully deploy working proof-of-stake systems, which limit attack vectors by requiring permission or payment to join the network. In this way, proof-of-stake systems are feasible, but will be slower growing, owing to the need to vet participants and more expensive to operate in practical terms, for the same reason, and owing to the need for security measures that wouldn't otherwise be needed in a proof-of-work system, which is expensive to attack. The necessary exclusivity required for proof-of-stake to function limits its utility, and limits the growth potential of any network which relies upon proof-of-stake as its primary consensus mechanism. Proof-of-stake networks will be undermined by cheaper, more reliable, more secure, and more accessible systems based on proof-of-work. Proof-of-stake as an abstraction layer on top of proof-of-work. Whether some form of proof-of-stake will ever replace proof-of-work as the predominant consensus mechanism is currently one of the most debated topics in cryptocurrency. As we have argued, there are theoretical limitations to the security of proof-of-stake schemes. However, they do have some merits when used in combination with proof-of-work. In Nakamoto proof-of-work consensus, it can be said that, quote, one CPU is one vote. In proof-of-stake, it can be said that one coin is one vote. Distributing influence over coin holders arguably creates a wider and more liquid distribution for Coinbase rewards than the mere paying of miners, who, as we have discussed, have incentive to cartelize in an attack scenario. Therefore, proof-of-stake may be an effective addition to proof-of-work systems if used to improve human consensus about network rules. However, it is not robust enough to be used alone. Taking a step back, proof-of-work and proof-of-stake can be considered to exist at two different abstraction layers. Proof-of-work is the layer that is closest to the bare metal, connecting hardware and physical resources to create distributed machine consensus. Proof-of-stake may be useful for coordinating dynamic human behavior in such a system, once immutability of the underlying ledger and asset is guaranteed by proof-of-work. An interesting architectural design is to use proof-of-work to produce blocks and proof-of-stake to give full node operators a voice in which blocks they collectively accept. These systems split the Coinbase reward between miners and full node validators instead of delivering 100% of rewards to miners. Stakeholders are incentivized to run full nodes and vote on any changes miners want to make to the way they produce blocks. The thinking goes like this. When compensated, full node operators can be trusted to act honestly in order to collect the staking reward and increase the value of their coins. Similarly, miners are incentivized to honestly produce blocks in order that their blocks are validated, not rejected, by stakeholders' full nodes. In this way, networks with proof-of-work for base layer machine consensus and proof-of-stake for Coinbase reward distribution and human consensus can be said to be hybrid networks. Such hybrid proof-of-work, proof-of-stake architectures may prevent the network from descending into a delicate balance of terror, miner control, or into tyranny of structurelessness, developer control. These systems allow decisions about the rules of machine consensus to be taken by more than one group of stakeholders, instead of solely among core developers, as in traditional open allocation, or among large miners in a cartel. Summary. In this section, we have elucidated how computers on the Bitcoin network achieve decentralized and distributed consensus at a global scale. We've examined why proof-of-work is a critical enabler of machine consensus and how proof-of-stake, while flawed, may be used in addition to proof-of-work to make human consensus, i.e., project governance, more transparent and inclusive. In the next section, we will discuss the value of public cryptocurrency systems when stakeholders are held in a stable balance of power. All right, and we have completed section 5, so we will be hitting section 6 tomorrow. Again, this is the iterative capital thesis on the cryptocurrency phenomenon, and that was all about machine consensus via proof of work. Now, I will say one caveat, just in my personal opinion, with the proof of stake, proof of work combination is I do not see rewarding node operators. That was one of my first things that during the whole debate is that it seemed like a good thing. Shouldn't we reward node operators for supporting the network, essentially? And I had a bit of a back and forth with Greg Maxwell and a couple of people back in the day about it, and they brought up some extremely good points which I hadn't thought of. First, that kind of a thing is really easy to civil attack. Of course, with proof of stake, it would be a little bit different. You'd have to actually have the coins. But it does change the nature of consensus, which I think is really, really dangerous. It politicizes the process of running a node, of staking or owning a share in the network. And I don't think someone, just because they have 100,000 coins, should have more say over where the network goes. And I think it would give the illusion, whether it was real or not, that they had more decision power over whether or not the network made a change. And it would immediately turn it into a really messy political process, which I think the reason the interesting thing about running a node right now is that everyone is independent and each node is equal to essentially one person. It doesn't matter exactly how much stake that person has. Like, let's say you have 100 Bitcoin or you have 0.01 Bitcoin. What's essentially going on when you're running a full node is you're defending against any attacking miner. Anyone who wishes to change the validation rules, your full node will automatically, without you doing anything, ignore their invalid rule change. There's no need for... It's like auditing your bank and being able to kick them out of your payment network if they try to cheat you. There's no need to reward that or make that some sort of... that is already a check on proof of work in and of itself, because proof of work cannot arbitrarily change the rules. A 51% attack is... one that's sustained is, yes, extremely expensive, but it's also not nearly as dangerous as the nuclear option, you know, so to speak. It doesn't destroy the network. It makes it unreliable to transact during the period of the, or accept confirmed transactions during the period of the attack. And any attack is not prolonged. We've had periods of extremely long block production or where, you know, maybe 5, 6, 7 confirmations were not a guarantee of a confirmed transaction. We've had long orphan chains and reorgs. It's been a very, very long time, but the network would survive. And the likelihood of anyone being able to sustain an attack that expensive is extremely unlikely. And in the meantime, everybody just waits 20 confirmations to accept their transaction. In essence, I think the proof of stake undermines the current security. Adding proof of stake as a full node system of voting, quote unquote, particularly in regards to splitting the Coinbase reward with full node operators, I think would actually undermine the security that a full node offers right now, because a full validating node isn't about changing the rules of the network. It's about preventing unwanted change to the network. And I think you want to get paid in digital gold, not digital cubic zirconium. So you simply run a node to make sure that it is exactly digital gold, it is Bitcoin, that you are receiving in your wallet, and you are validating to ensure that happens. So I don't really agree with the idea that it's a very interesting concept, and I think it could, I think it would be really interesting to see attempted on a network. I would be interested to watch a coin that attempted that type of system. I don't think there is one out there that does that, because it could be an interesting mix, but I do not think it would be superior to proof of work and the essentially the custodianship of all validating full nodes as the final say over what is a valid Bitcoin and what is not. So I just wanted to throw that little point in there because I thought that was an interesting section there at the end, but I did kind of take a little issue with the idea that it could be superior because I don't really think so. I think it kind of has its own little, I think it has its own incentive problems with trying to recreate a pseudo-political process, which I think is the point of Bitcoin, is to avoid the idea that it's a political process, that full nodes aren't about, running full nodes aren't about like getting everybody to agree on how we're going to change Bitcoin. It's about creating a defensive barrier against changing Bitcoin. Anyway, with that, I thought that was an interesting point. But I really love this section, everything about the proof of work and the history for people who were not here. It's amazing how much stuff happened. I remember trying to get, it was so fast, the switch from CPU to GPU to FPGA to ASICs. I remember I was looking at trying to get FPGAs back in the day. I mined on my GPU for just like a couple of weeks, and then it just took a nosedive to being completely a waste of time. And then I was like, maybe I should get some FPGAs. And about the time I was looking up trying to buy some FPGAs, it was like ASICs were hitting the market and people were investing all this money in pre-sales on Butterfly Labs and KNC Miner, and both of them massively underwhelmed. Butterfly Labs, for anybody who knows, said they're famous. Have you ever heard the 2 weeks trademark, like TM, that people would do as a meme now? They basically said at one point that they were 2 weeks away from delivering their product, and it was like a full year before anybody got their miners, and the quality was crap, and they had already gone, the market had already moved to like the next gen miners, and they weren't mining anything. People were furious. I almost bought one too. I almost brought the presale because you don't have any reliability or any history of these companies to go on. So it's like, you know, do I go with KNC? Do I go with ASIC Miner? Do I go with Butterfly Labs? Like, nobody has a reputation. So how would you know who was going to deliver and who wasn't? It's like flipping a coin. So it just, the craziness of the stuff that went on, it's just amazing how much they packed into this and yet how much still happened that they weren't able to cover. So I hope you guys are enjoying, this thesis here. This is just amazing for a full breakdown for people new to this, industry and this whole, you know, crypto economy. This really is a quintessential piece to break into the entire philosophy and even going over the limitations of proof of stake in a pretty succinct and solid manner. We've hit a couple of proof of stake articles on the podcast. Turnemeester, I think, has that incredible response to Vitalik's proof of stake proposal. And our proof of stake design philosophy, I think, is what it's called. That one I definitely recommend. I read both of those back to back: Vitalik's proof of stake design philosophy, and then Turnemeester's response to that. I do not remember what number they are. I'll try to look them up and put them in the show notes for you guys. But definitely go back if you want to do some deep dive into this topic. There's so much stuff going on this. I've hit a lot of different things about proof of work in the past, and it's just a really, really fun topic. But I am out of time, so I will catch you guys back here tomorrow with Section 6. We are getting through this thing, and there is still more awesome stuff to come, so do not miss it. Don't forget to check out iterative.capital, where they have tons of analysis and news and articles coming out all the time. There's plenty of stuff to read on this website. I've hit a couple of things so far, I've been really excited by what these guys have been producing. So definitely check out iterative.capital. And of course, If you want to support the show, please go to cryptoeconomy.life and save your Amazon affiliate link, save your Amazon bookmark as my affiliate link, which you can find at the top of the page. It just says Amazon affiliate, or there's an ad if you don't have an ad blocker. And if you do that, it sends me a small percentage of everything you buy on Amazon at no charge to you. So that's a wonderful, wonderful way to help out the show that doesn't cost you anything and just takes a little bit of time. Follow me on Twitter at The Crypto Economy and on Mastodon. We got the subreddit r/CryptoEconomy where I post this stuff every day. And of course, if you want to get to all of that stuff, just check out the website at cryptoeconomy.life. I've got tons of stuff coming. Stick with me, subscribe to the show on iTunes, and I will catch you all back here tomorrow with another episode of the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys.